Good afternoon, and welcome to the Guinness Atkinson Dividend Builders Q2 2016 conference call and webinar. All participants will be in listen-only mode. After today's presentation, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions. If you are at your computer, please submit your questions in the questions chat box located on the bottom of your webinar control panel, or you may submit your questions directly to trogers@dakotafunds.com. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Mr. Matthew Page and Dr. Ian Mortimer, portfolio managers for Guinness Atkinson Asset Management. Gentlemen, please go ahead.
Thanks, Tracy, and welcome to everyone on the call. Straight away, just to page two. This is just the biographies of myself and Matthew Page. We are the co-managers of this strategy, and we've been working together running sort of global equities for pushing on for 7 years now. I'll leave you to read that maybe at your leisure.
If we go to slide four, what you'll notice on this chart is that pretty much when you look in aggregate, companies that yield more than 4% on a forecast basis tend to actually cut their dividend in reality. The realized dividend yield that you get is often quite a bit lower than the forecast dividend yield. You're instantly hit with an income that is lower than what you're expecting. If we go on to the next slide five, as important to that is how share prices perform in anticipation of a dividend cut. You can see on this slide that companies that cut their dividend, actually a lot of the pain in the performance happens in the 6 to 9 months preceding that actual dividend cut. You can see on this chart at time zero in the middle there, actually a lot of the price pain has already happened in the previous 6 to 9 months. Kind of what we want to do is try and find a way of, or a system of looking for companies that have the ability to maintain their dividends and hopefully grow their dividends over time. We spent a lot of time thinking and working on this, and the conclusion that we came to based on the evidence was that companies that maintain a consistently high return on capital are actually very likely to grow their dividend. If you go to the next slide six, what you'll see on this chart is on the vertical axis is the average return on capital of groups of companies, and they're grouped by what you can see on the horizontal axis. On the left-hand side there, you can see companies that have had no dividend upgrades in the last 10 years. On the far right, you can see what those companies that have had a dividend upgrade in each of the last 10 years. What you notice is there's quite a strong correlation between the return on capital or the average return on capital over that 10-year period and the number of dividend upgrades they had over that period. What we conclude is that looking for companies that consistently generate high return on capital over a prolonged period of time, and by which we often look at a decade, we're giving ourselves a very good chance of finding companies that aren't, number one, are very unlikely to cut their dividends, so we're unlikely to get the pain in terms of the price performance, but we're also very likely to find companies that are able to grow their dividend. We think dividend growth is a very powerful driver of price performance over the longer term as well. If we go to the next slide seven, you'll see that's exactly what we do. We start by looking for companies that have got a 10-year track record of generating a return on capital that essentially is in the top 25% of all companies globally in each of those years. We do that using our measure of cash flow return on investment, which is a measure that Credit Suisse Holt have developed. And you can see that takes us from 16,000 companies globally down to 600. So it's a very high hurdle rate for companies. And then we wanted to apply a couple of other criteria. The first one is a debt-to-equity ratio of less than 100%. Now, history shows us that those companies with lots of debt, stretched balance sheets, are often the first place to get hit in any sort of economic shock or downturn. And I think that's particularly relevant today in the light of what many US mid-cap stocks have been doing, whereby they are hitting levels of debt to EBITDA that are around sort of 10 to 20 year highs. So we need to be cautious of those. And then the second element is a market cap of more than $1 billion. And what that does is it defines an investable universe of companies that statistically are likely to be able to grow their dividend into the future and that are highly likely to be able to weather whatever economic storm may be thrown at them. So with that, I will pass you over to Ian to talk a bit more in terms of, you know, how do we actually put that philosophy into practice?
Thanks, Matt, and hello to everyone. It's Ian Mortimer here. So if I could turn the page to page 8, what we're going to do now is sort of move on a little bit and talk about the actual fund and the strategy and how we employ some of those ideas that Matt had been discussing earlier. So on this page, we can just see some basic information about the dividend builder strategy. And ultimately, the fund is seeking to invest in sort of quality companies at attractive valuations. We try and do that through a pretty disciplined, systematic approach. One of the ways we do that is having a very focused portfolio of our best ideas. So we actually run a 35-stock portfolio. We equally weight our positions. So our position size of all of our stocks we own is around 3%. And what this means is we have a very high active share versus our benchmark, which is the MSCI World. And that high active share is actually probably something like 95% plus. So if you think about it, our sort of equally weighted 3% position means we are genuinely index agnostic. We do not weight our names or the companies we own in our portfolio based on what the index looks like. We're also very much buy and hold, so low turnover. Typically, we're holding our stocks for somewhere between 3 and 5 years. And then lastly, as Matt says, it's sort of dividend growth we're targeting, not high yield. So the sort of running yield of the portfolio is probably around the sort of 2.93% level, depending on where the price is today. And we would aim to grow that somewhere between the sort of 3 and 5%. So if we then move on to page 9, what I can show you here is the sort of the four main tenets of our investment philosophy. And these are four things that we always come back to in terms of trying to think about the characteristics of the portfolio we're providing and whether we are continuing to provide that. So the four things we look at are, number one, the quality of the underlying company. And this is a sort of very key element of what we're thinking about. We're not looking at the dividend first. We're looking at how good is this company through the lens of its sort of return on capital. As Matt says, we're focusing on those that have this persistently top quartile return on capital over a decade. We're then very much value biased, so we always try and identify some kind of valuation discount in the companies we own. And we do this very much from a bottom-up perspective, so we try not to make sort of big macro calls on the portfolio. It's a moderate dividend, and it's a growing income stream we're targeting. And then lastly, that conviction. So the 35 stock equally weighted and the low turnover is something we're also very conscious of. So if we then move on to page 10, what you can see here is just a very sort of high-level overview of the process, if you like, of moving from the 500 quality companies that we've identified very objectively to how we actually get 35 stocks in the portfolio. So the way we do this is in essentially two stages, the first of which is sort of a prioritization or idea generation screen. So here we're kind of focusing on the three elements we'd like to see. So one is business strength. So that's trying to think about how that return on capital will continue to be good, how it may grow. The second thing is that valuation. How much do we have to pay for this company, either versus its peers, versus the broader market, or versus where the company has traded historically? And then the final thing is the dividend. Do we think that dividend is sustainable? Do we think that dividend can grow? And do we think that dividend will still be sustainable over the longer term? And the way we do this, though, if you think about it, is we're really trying to focus on where our total return is coming from. So if we split down our total return of any sort of investment in an equity, you think it will come through three ways. The first is sort of through operational growth. So that's kind of growing your earnings, if you like, whether it's through revenue growth or expanding your margins. So we think we're going to get that through that business strength. The second part of your total return is from multiple expansion. That's where we're focusing on, or why we're focusing on, the value element. And then the third element is really from sort of shareholder return. And that's going to come through dividends, dividends growth, and then also share buybacks. So our whole philosophy is to try and think about generating a total return from all three parts of those available. And we think that gives us a good chance of having a fairly repeatable process and one that can do well through most economic environments. The next stage is then more technical. We'd be delighted to talk about this in more detail offline. And here is really where we're spending time actually analysing the companies, modelling those companies, thinking about what they're doing versus their peers, and then really coming up with essentially a price target or a considered valuation for ourselves. And here really we're thinking about, well, maybe we'll look at the company, we don't really like the business, so we'll reject the idea. Maybe we really like the business, but the valuation is too rich, you'll go on a watch list. Or we really think, yeah, you know, we both like the business and the valuation, in which case it's a potential portfolio addition. What we do have, though, is a one-in, one-out philosophy. So therefore, we're constantly thinking about what we own. And if we want to put something in the portfolio, we've got to think about what we're selling. So what we think is, ultimately, it's a pretty systematic, repeatable, and robust process. And what's pleasing is that the performance we've generated through this is obviously all coming from that sort of systematic approach of that process. We have not got our good performance through one or two very large overweight positions that happen to have done well. Our equally weighted nature means obviously we have not done that. So if we then move on to page 11, what we can see here is just the performance of the fund over Q2, in Q1, year to date, and slightly over the longer term. So if we're focusing specifically on Q2, you know, we are pleasingly ahead of our benchmark, the MSCI World, again. And if we think about what's happened throughout this year so far, we've had pretty difficult markets. So if you cast your mind back to Q1, we had a very, very steep sell-off in markets through the first 6 weeks of the year, based on worries around sort of Chinese economic growth. And you can see in Q1 that the fund, again, held up incredibly well. Q2, we've then had fairly flat markets actually through the first sort of 2.5 months of Q2. And then in the last 2 weeks, obviously, we've had the Brexit issues of the UK voting to leave the European Union, which has then transpired into very large currency moves, particularly sterling and the yen. And then also worries around sort of economic growth in Europe, which will then have potential knock-on effects throughout the rest of the world. So again, pretty choppy markets. And again, the fund has held up very well. And what we've historically found is the way we run the fund and the elements we focus on tends to generate performance that matches that we have seen over Q1 and Q2. The quality element, the valuation element, the moderate yield and growing dividend has typically meant this fund has performed better in sort of market sell-offs, relatively. With the flip side being, maybe we don't catch as much of the upside if markets rally very sharply. So it's been very pleasing that over the first half of 2016, the fund has performed exactly as we might have expected. If you then move on to page 12, we can just see this performance split down into calendar years, and then also the cumulative performance of the strategy versus the MSCI World Benchmark. And you can just see there, just to highlight that sort of 2016 year-to-date number, as I was discussing earlier. If we then move on to page 13, we can look a little bit more closely about some of the stocks that we've owned that did well during Q2, and some of the stocks that didn't do quite so well during Q2. And I think if you look at the stocks that have done well, we would describe this as a sort of a relatively mixed bag, but maybe some of the currency moves may have affected a little bit, to some extent, some of these businesses. So Largan Precision is our Taiwanese holding. This is a sort of technology company and makes the lenses for smartphones. So this is very much a sort of company-specific issue in that the company has shown good results, sort of growing revenues and margins, and therefore has been rewarded as such in the market. So that's actually been one of our best performers year to date. Aflac, from a similar perspective, actually has pretty decent exposure in terms of revenue to the Japanese market. So maybe the sort of strengthening yen could have had an effect there in the sense of moving those revenues back into sort of US dollars. Royal Dutch Shell, I think, is a company that has done well on the back of the rising oil price from its lows in sort of the early part of the year, sort of end of January, early February, and also from a slight restructuring of that business in the sense of these a lot of the super majors looking at sort of focusing more on their returns on capital, return on equity, and therefore that's been, again, rewarded by the market. Johnson & Johnson, just a very strong business and potentially one that the market has been sort of buying into, if you like, in the sense of a sort of safe haven, if you like, in terms of sort of where you might look to invest during sort of difficult periods. And I think that's probably what the market's reward is. Sonic Healthcare is our healthcare business in Australia. And again, more on sort of good performance on a stock specific basis. In terms of the bottom five performing stocks, I think Leon Fung and H&R Block have been continued to perform fairly weakly during Q2, sort of following on from their poor results during Q1. I think ICAP and WPP are two holdings we own which are listed in the UK. And I think the fact as I mentioned, the Brexit vote at the end of June will have affected the performance more significantly on these two stocks. And that's kind of interesting, the fact that WPP is actually pretty much a global sort of advertising business. So we think maybe that sell-off could be a little bit overdone. And Microsoft, a little bit of weakness in the share price, following on from what has been excellent performance in that stock, and then also maybe a reflection of the price they maybe had to pay for some of their sort of LinkedIn acquisitions. So if we then move on to the next page, page 14, you may have to squint a little bit, I'm afraid, but this is showing you the portfolio as it stood at the end of the quarter. And this is showing you all the stocks we own, and we have ordered it by the sector. And then we've shown the market cap, country of domicile, the percentage of NAV, and then some PE multiples based on consensus estimates. And what would I say here? The first thing I'd say is the median market cap of the portfolio today stands at about $37 billion. You can see that at the bottom of the page. This is probably the slightly higher or the larger market cap end of where we've maybe looked historically. But we do, again, if you cast your eye down the third column from the left, you can see we do own a handful of companies on this sort of sub $10 billion range. So it's not that we are hugely skewed, if you like, to the large cap names, but obviously we own some of the very large companies such as Microsoft, Walmart, etc. In terms of the things we'd really look for, though, is if you look at the bottom right-hand part of this chart and the numbers in red, this is showing you the total portfolio PE based on 2016 expected earnings and then going forward into 2017 expected earnings. We would be quite cautious about reading too much into the 2017 expected earnings. These are just based on consensus estimates. But if we look at the 2016 expected earnings, you can see the portfolio today is trading on 16 times, and that's actually at a 4.8% discount to the MSCI World, which is trading at 16.8. So despite the fact that we focused on high-quality businesses, the average 10-year CFROI of a business in our portfolio is about 20%. The index is about 10. We have pretty reasonable debt to equity, so none of our companies are, or in aggregate, are overly leveraged. I think it's actually less, the net debt to equity weighted average is less than 50% for our portfolio. So the index is about 67. You can see the fund still offers a discount, despite the fact you have these better quality, lower leverage businesses. And then when we consider the dividend, the portfolio is still providing a dividend that's probably somewhere between sort of 10 and 15% greater than the MSCI World, and we think has a better chance to grow. So we still think, you know, if you're sort of worried about sort of what markets are doing, maybe it's from a valuation perspective, maybe you're worried about sort of geographic exposures, for example. You know, we think a sort of a global portfolio of these types of businesses with those types of characteristics actually provides a pretty interesting way of maybe putting money to work in today's market. So if we then move on to page 15, we can just see the sector breakdown, the market cap distribution, and the regional breakdown of the funds. And this is just a snapshot at the end of the quarter. What you can see is consumer staples remains our largest holding. This is probably 4 or 5% overweight versus the benchmark. And that's really come through the fact that we've actually topped this up a little bit in Q1, if you recall. We actually bought a position back into Walmart. So actually, at the start of the year, we were probably maybe 17, 16% consumer staples, and we've upped that a ton of drops. And we're broadly in line with the benchmark, sort of plus or minus 2%. The things I'd also mention again is, in terms of materials exposure, in terms of utilities exposure, the fund continues to have zero holdings in each of those sectors, or in either of those sectors, sorry. I think that's quite interesting if you think about performance over Q2, is that things like utilities have done very well. People looking for the sort of safety, if you like, of those types of businesses. And then you've also seen a very strong rally in some of the materials businesses through rising commodity prices, particularly if you're thinking about the gold miners. Some of those have shown sort of 50, 60% type increases over the very short term. So the fact our fund outperformed the benchmark, again, has not been the sort of big overweights in a couple of sectors that might have done particularly or extraordinarily well over a short period. The market cap distribution remains relatively stable relative to where we were at the end of last quarter. And in terms of our regional breakdown, again, our US exposure of 50%, Europe at sort of 32%, Asia, Japan, Middle East, North Africa making up the rest. What I would say is I think it's what is relevant to think about our European exposure to split out maybe our UK exposure. So today, I think we own four companies in the UK, and they are, as I mentioned earlier, WPP and ICAP, and then also Unilever and BAE Systems. Now, if you think about three of those companies, WPP, BAE Systems, Unilever, these are very much globally diversified businesses. With actually quite a small proportion of their revenues coming from the UK. I think all three of them are sub 20% of their revenues. ICAP is the one that's probably a little bit more exposed to that. So this is the interdealer broker and sort of Brexit issues, but we don't think necessarily in a huge way. If you split out our portfolio by revenues, what you'll see is that by revenues, our UK exposure is about 5%. So if I move on to the next page, here we can look at just how the sector allocation, the geographic allocation has evolved over time. And this is just showing you exactly what the portfolios look like and how it's evolved since we launched this fund at the end of Q1 in 2012. So as I said, we haven't made any changes to the portfolio this quarter, so therefore this has remained relatively stable. If we then move on to page 17, this just highlights in graphical form those over and underweights I was talking about earlier in terms of our distribution versus that MSCI World benchmark. What I'd like to say, though, here is before I sort of hand over to Matt, is that it's worth remembering that, as we sort of said at the beginning, we run this very much from a bottom-up perspective. We are not running this fund with reference to the benchmark, but we are running the fund of being aware of that benchmark. So the fact we're sort of overweight or underweight certain sectors is more a reflection of where we're seeing sort of valuations and opportunities from a fundamental perspective, rather than necessarily us taking sort of bigger views on which sectors we do or do not want to be in. So with that, I'll then pass you back over to Matt, who's just going to talk a little bit about maybe some sort of interesting things we've maybe seen in the market over Q2.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. So if we go to the next slide, slide 18, you'll see what we think was probably the most interesting aspects over the last quarter, which was the significant moves that we've seen in currencies against the dollar. Obviously, post the Brexit referendum, we've seen a very significant weakening of sterling, but we've also seen a weakening of other European currencies as well, be that obviously the euro, but also the Norwegian krona, the Swiss franc, and the Swedish krona as well. Where's the money gone? It's gone to the perceived safe haven of Japan, the Japanese yen having strengthened by over 9.1% against the dollar over that quarter. And if we go to the next slide, the other sort of key characteristic that we've seen, obviously, is much lower yields across the board. So we've shown here the yield curve of the US 10-year Treasury, the UK 10-year gilt, the German 10-year Bund and the Japanese bonds as well. And we see the shift in that yield curve over that period. And you'll note now that in Germany and Japan, the 10-year government bond is now offering a negative yield. The US, we've seen the 10-year yield drop maybe 40 basis points, whereas in the UK, the 10-year gilt, the yield on that has pretty much halved over this quarter, with much of that coming post-Brexit. Equities have pretty much been flat, though, over this period, you know, plus or minus, depending where you look in the world. So if we go to the next slide, we can just look at the spread between the dividend yield on US equities, as represented by the S&P 500, less the yields on the 10-year Treasury. So what sort of upside are you getting from investing in, you know, large cap dividend yielding equities relative to government bonds? And it's interesting to note that where we are today in the US is pretty much at a 5-year high. And if we go to the next slide and look at Europe, and what we're doing here is looking at the MSCI Europe ex-UK versus the 10-year German Bund, you can see here the picture is even more vivid in that, you know, we were hitting a high, a sort of a 10-year high back at the turn of the year, and that has just gone higher. So we think, you know, from a tactical point of view, you know, investing in companies offering decent dividend yields, this is quite an interesting timing. But I also think, given where valuations are in the market, you do need to consider what you're actually investing in rather than simply just chasing yield. And I certainly think that, you know, high quality global equities, we've seen it in period and period before, when markets become uncertain, we see a dash to this sort of attractive quality. And I think post-Brexit, this isn't just a UK issue. This is an issue that is going to, I think, spread throughout Europe. I think there are going to be other countries that potentially question their place in the EU. And it's also worth noting that actually the mechanics of calling a referendum in the UK are actually quite complicated and quite difficult to do. If you look at other countries in the EU, their ability to call a referendum on such an issue is much more straightforward. So if we continue to see worsening sentiment towards the EU, then, you know, we could well see ourselves in that type of environment in the not too distant future. So I think that's, if we go to the final slide, that sums up everything we prepared to discuss today, but we'll happily hand it back over to some questions.
Ian and Matt, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. As a friendly reminder to our audience, if you have any questions, please feel free to submit your questions in the questions chat box located on the bottom of your webinar navigation bar, or you may email them to trogers@dakotafunds.com. First question for you, and you did touch a little on this a little bit through your comments, but how do you adjust the portfolio in the wake of the Brexit vote?
Yeah, so what we're doing, so far we have not made any changes to the portfolio in response to that. I think, you know, obviously we are investing globally, and the UK, whilst having historically been an important source of, you know, high-quality dividend-paying companies, it's a relatively small part of our opportunity set. So if you look at the 500 companies that meet our criteria of generating this 10-year consistently high return on capital, about 50 of those are from the UK, and the other 450 are obviously outside, and about half of 500 are coming from the US. So it's a relatively small part of our opportunity set. I think if you look at what's happened in the UK equity market, what, you know, you've seen a sort of divergence in performance. If you look at the FTSE 100, the 100 largest companies, 12 companies make up over 50% of the weight of that index. And if you look at those companies, they are all really global in nature. And those companies have held up extremely well because they're generating their revenues in dollars. Whereas if you look at the other 88 stocks in that FTSE 100, certainly those that are more UK domestically focused, for example, like UK house builders, retailers, these companies have been hit harder. Generally speaking, our approach does not take us into owning banks. So whilst UK banks have been hit particularly hard, that's not an area that we are really looking at. But there are other financials like asset managers and exchanges that we have been taking a closer look at. But we haven't pulled the trigger on any of those yet.
Thank you so much. Next question. Are you finding attractive ideas given the recent volatility, global volatility?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, well, in both ways, in fact, in some respects, but, you know, we've seen some of the, some of the holdings we own have actually performed extraordinarily well in terms of the attractiveness of those types of businesses. So I think that's been a sort of something we've been considering in terms of sort of sales. But to your question, yes, certainly there's been, volatility throws up opportunity. And I think the fact that we have a sort of a global outlook, if you like, has been particularly beneficial for us. One of the interesting phenomena through the sort of the recent sell-off, or the very short-term sell-off, sort of the week after Brexit, if you like, was actually quite a lot of emerging market stocks performed very well. So they held up, which typically you would not expect. So again, that's, and if you then think about that from a valuation perspective, some of these types of businesses in those types of regions are maybe trading on sort of 10 times multiples versus, say, the US market that's trading, maybe you've got to pay 18 times, 20 times. And I think what we're just trying to assess at the moment is the sort of the outlook for those individual businesses and whether we can get comfortable enough that they will remain solid, if you like, despite maybe the headwinds we've got of whether it's a stronger dollar, et cetera.
Great. Thank you both so much. It looks like that concludes our Q&A for this afternoon. I would just like to turn the call back over to the two of you for any closing remarks today.
Yeah, well, just to thank you all again for dialing in, and we look forward to sharing our thoughts with you at the end of the next quarter.
The conference is now concluded, and I will now read through some required disclosures. Mutual fund investing involves risk. Risk and loss of principal is possible. Investments in foreign securities involve greater volatility, political, economic, and currency risks, and differences in accounting methods. These risks are greater for emerging market countries. The fund also invests in smaller companies, which will involve additional risks, such as limited liquidity and greater volatility. The fund may invest in derivatives, which involves risks, different from and in certain cases, greater than the risks presented by traditional investments. Fund holdings and/or sector allocations are subject to change at any time and are not recommendations to buy or sell any security. Thank you all for attending today's presentation, and you may now disconnect your phone.